We, of course, believe that's going to break out to the upside, not just because we're biased and we want it to, but because we understand the physical market. That's where we spend most of our time. Most of our time is on the physical market. We want to know what's going on in the physical market. So for example, this move down from $102, $103 down to $90, that has largely taken place based on an extremely quiet spot market, because the utilities and everybody that was in the spot market in December and January pushing the price up went, whoa, okay, we're going to step back here for a minute. And we have a single trader offering up a few hundred thousand pounds into a quiet market that moved the price down $10. If you don't know that, you might think, okay,
it's over.
It's over. It's reversing. It's done. We, of course, are going to take the other side of that bet. So we think things will break out to the upside.
Justin, how are you?
I'm doing really well. How about yourself? Thanks for having me on today.
No, thanks for coming on. Really, let's get right to it, is setting up for uranium. We've had such this big run in the past 8 months, if you would. It's gone, I would even call it a parabolic. And then we've sold off here recently in the last probably 3 weeks, 4 weeks, which is very much to be expected and is a very sign of a healthy market in my mind. Where are we at now? Let's start with that.
I would say right now we're kind of consolidating the most recent move, both in the commodity and in the equities. So we saw the spot price of uranium move from the low 50s in August all the way to $107 a pound in just earlier last month in February. So it basically doubled in less than 6 months. Historically speaking, that's an enormous move for this commodity. It's a commodity that can go years and years and years without doing a whole lot. The sector moves very, very slowly. The primary consumers of the material, which are nuclear utilities, uranium being the fuel for nuclear energy, right?
Right.
And the first step in a fuel cycle that can take up to 24 months to go from the mined uranium through conversion, enrichment, deconversion, fuel fabrication, and that material shipped off to the utility. That takes a very long time, which is one of the reasons why the sector moves so slowly, and nuclear utilities tend to secure their needs in a long-term market, buying many years out on the curve and securing a large number of pounds far into the future. So it's a unique sector in that way. But for the commodity to move that much in that short of a period of time, that's should be a very big signal to the structure of the physical market. And right now we're kind of in the middle of a consolidation. So we have the sector basically saying, okay, that escalated quickly.
Right.
What now? And there's a lot of moving parts, a lot of detail that I'm happy to provide with why the price moved in that manner and what we can expect going forward. So we're like, what, 4 weeks into this period where the commodities pulled back from that peak, recent peak of $107, $108 a pound, down to about $90 a pound right now. Still far, far above what it was just a few months back, but a short-term, in my opinion, what will be a short-term pullback. There's no near-term sufficient supply to balance this market and the needs of the nuclear utilities going forward in the next few years before we can have meaningful supply respond. So we expect the upward pressure to continue on the commodity.
Got it. So let's unpack that a lot. You mentioned that there are many different factors of why we moved the way we did. Talk about that. Why did we move so quickly? But also, I want to give some context to that, because for years, uranium didn't move. But I was bullish or mild bull, or just, I would say, very interested from somewhat of a distance. It's like, someday this is going to move. And then boy, did it. And it just moved too fast for me, if you would. So yeah, tell me what happened.
So the sector went through a pretty brutal bear market. And based on kind of the factors I just mentioned with how slowly things can move and how the nuclear utilities typically secure their fuel needs in the forward market, we had the Fukushima Daiichi accident in 2011. The anniversary was yesterday, actually. We're recording this on March 12th. So that accident in and of itself caused the Japanese to shut down all of their reactors in response to that accident. That process took a couple of years, but the demand, that was more than 10% of the world's demand for uranium in, with their nuclear fleet, which is a very large fleet at the time. They've since restarted 11 reactors. They had 53, 54 operating prior to Fukushima. So after that accident, that was a big hit to demand. At the same time, you had the Kazakhs ramping production during that same period. So 2011 to 2016, the Kazakhs continued to drastically increase their annual production. At the same time, demand dropped off a cliff. So that led to a long-term bear market. The commodity actually bottomed in 2016, which happened to coincide with the biggest year for Kazakhstan producing uranium. That was $18 a pound, far below the average cost of production. The Kazakhs could make money at that period of time, barely at $18 a pound, but primarily because they had a substantial currency play with a depreciating Kazakh tenge, where that was priced for all of their production costs, and then they would sell in US dollars. Once they went partially public in 2018, they became more of a responsible producer, which they continue to be. But that long-term bear market led to very low prices. The original kind of contrarian thesis was, okay, this sector isn't dead. It's growing a tiny amount. This is back 2016, 17, 18, right? It's growing a little bit. It's almost 10% of the world's electricity, which is a lot. It's a vital sector. The commodity is hated. The equities are bombed out and ignored. This is a contrarian bet. And we're betting on the uranium price going from 18 up to the average cost of production, which at the time was maybe, you know, $40 to $50 a pound.
Right.
And we're making a bet on that, on the sector recovering from terrible to just bad and the commodity going up a little bit. That was the bet then. During that period of time, a lot has happened. Obviously, we had COVID. We had some mining interruptions during that. We've seen a complete 180 in sentiment around nuclear over the last about 5 years. And the primary reasons for that are both, I guess they're numerous, but I would say the primary reasons would be, let's say, the environmental left starting to embrace nuclear and recognizing that it is actually clean energy. So it's been maligned, whether it's by the anti-nuclear lobby that's being funded by solar and wind and fossil fuel companies, or by The Simpsons and having Homer screw up by dropping a glowing fuel rod and having three-eyed fish swimming in the cooling pond outside the reactor. You know, those kind of things, they actually do affect overall public sentiment about this misunderstood sector. So now that the environmental left is, especially over the past 5-6 years, has been in an absolute panic about carbon emissions and quote-unquote climate change, recognizing that, well, if this is the case, and if carbon is to be demonized in the way that we are saying that it should be, then we should be embracing nuclear energy. And finally, they are. That took quite a few years to happen, but it's fully happening now. Nuclear is recognized at the COP conference just this recent in Dubai in November of last year. The second year that nuclear even had a seat at the table, and this year or last year, they had 24 countries pledging to triple nuclear energy by 2050. This is something that was never on any of our bingo cards. And when I say our, talking about the handful of people that were interested in this investment back in 16, 17, 18. So that has led to somewhat of a nuclear renaissance. And then, of course, there's things like just straight up energy security in the past couple of years, especially with the war in Ukraine and Russia sort of weaponizing energy to Europe. Baseload reliable electricity has become more and more valuable, regardless of carbon emissions or not. Right. So just having secure, reliable baseload electricity, and nuclear is very unique in that realm because you can store years and years and years of fuel in a small warehouse. And so that's hugely advantageous to any country that wants to be energy secure and energy independent. And then most recently, I would say that there's kind of this new wave of highlighting electricity security in terms of significantly increased energy demand based on data centers and AI. And this is just emerging. This is also something that not a lot of us foresaw even just a few years back. And now that AI is really taking off and, you know, the energy demand for, like, for example, just an AI-based search compared to a normal like Google search is orders of magnitude more energy intensive.
Right.
Far more electricity. And we just recently saw Amazon, AWS purchase a data cloud center that's powered by nuclear. And so, and that's going to, we think that's a growing theme, that the electricity demand coming from this is going to seek out baseload power. And with the focus on clean energy, if you don't have hydroelectricity or geothermal, which most places don't, the only other option for baseload and clean is nuclear. So we think this is a huge tailwind for the sector. It doesn't mean new uranium demand tomorrow, but it does potentially mean a much, much longer runway for this investment, for the growth of this industry.
Sure. Yeah, it's compounded over time. It'd be a huge tailwind, if you would. Let me ask you then, so you brought us just up to speed to where we're at now. There's two things I want to talk about and really curious. Well, there's some things I'm really curious. And number one is, okay, so let's project this out 24 months, 12 to 24 months and beyond. Let's project that out here. And then let's also talk about the politics of it. And then what I mean by that is the geopolitics, because a lot of this has really big nation states, if you would, that are very interested or have become very interested in uranium and all energy, just so for their growth and their own security. Let's talk about that afterwards. What does that mean to the price, if you would, and for an investor?
Well, there's one really unique element to this commodity, and that is that it's somewhat price inelastic. So a nuclear utility, on average, the cost of uranium fuel is between 3% and 5% of the overall operating budget of that facility. So to see the price rise substantially for this commodity, typically, in most cases, doesn't actually affect the operations of that facility. And in most cases, that increased cost can actually be passed on to the ratepayers. So despite the fact that we've seen the price of uranium go from $18 to just under $100 here, we're seeing more and more countries life extend their existing reactors or make plans to build reactors. The cost of the fuel is essentially immaterial with these decisions, which goes to show you that the focus really is on the clean element of the energy and the baseload reliability of the energy, right, energy security. And more and more countries are moving in the direction of what China is doing. Now, not to that extent, but in that direction. So China right now has 26 reactors currently under construction, large reactors. These are all, or almost all of them are more than 1,000 megawatts. A lot of these Hualong 1, 1,000 megawatt reactors, these are very large reactors. They also are planning on greatly increasing the number of reactors in the overall nuclear fleet for multiple decades. So they're now talking about targeting, I believe it was something like 600 megawatts by 2060, right? So right now, or 600 gigawatts, excuse me, by 2060. Right now they have 55 gigawatts. So their 2035 goal is 150 gigawatts. So they're trying to add 95 gigawatts in the next 10 years. That's a big ask. Yeah. I don't think they'll quite hit it, but I do think they will continue on this pace of 6 to 8 new reactors hitting the grid every single year. So to put that into context, that's the amount crazy of uranium that's going to be mined this year out of the ground is about 150 million pounds.
Okay.
10 years from now, China will be consuming half of that on an annual basis.
Just
so 150 gigawatts is about 75 million pounds of uranium per year.
And how much is China's consumption relative to the rest of the world?
Well, currently with 55 gigawatts, their consumption is about 25 million pounds a year. And consumption right now is about 185 million pounds a year. So what is that? That's about 15%
okay,
they consume on an annual basis. The United States consumes about 25%. They still have the largest fleet, but China will be a larger fleet than the United States within 5 years. That's okay. How fast they're building that fleet.
So really the bottom line is that their consumption is going to exponentially really increase as they build plants, and then their demand just soars again exponentially. Well, really, I guess then what about the rest of the world then? Is the rest of the world, like, for example, I think of big economies such as, India, or also I think of Europe, the rest of Europe, and again, very conscientious of being clean energy. What does their consumption look like?
Well, it's interesting because China will sort of tell you that they're putting a focus on clean energy, but in reality, they're looking for energy.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
And kind of the same thing goes for India. India just recently, within the past few weeks, announced that they're increasing their build-out plans. So they're actually kind of operating in fleet mode. They're building multiples of the same design, both this Russian design, this VVER reactor, as well as heavy water reactors. They have a number of both of these currently operating. And they're planning, if I recall correctly, to have 18 new reactors online in the next 8 years. Eight of those are under construction right now, or seven or eight of those are under construction. Maybe it was seven. So that'd be an additional 11. So that's a pretty fast pace. India, historically speaking, hasn't been able to hit their goals in terms of their nuclear, their nuclear ambitions.
Right.
But same thing with China. They haven't quite hit those goals either, but they're still the largest build out. So India's moving in the same direction. I think the most important point to make, especially with both of these countries, but especially China, is that China over the past 18 months has been the most aggressive buyer of uranium.
Okay.
And so they have signed two different Chinese utilities have signed two very large contracts with Kazatomprom, which is the company that operates out of Kazakhstan. And knowing,
they just announced, I don't mean to interrupt you, but
no, it's okay.
About, I don't know, 6 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, didn't they announce that they're not going to hit? I read that they're not going to hit their production targets. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that's correct. They announced that back in early February, about a month ago. So their targets they announced last year that they intended to drastically increase their production. They announced this back in September that they wanted to increase. So they have these things called subsoil use agreements, which is basically their licensed production levels. And they're allowed to go 20% in either direction of that level. So over the past 4 years, they've been operating at 20% below those subsoil use agreements. So in what they've been expressing as voluntary production cuts, value over volume is kind of their tagline, right? So they're acknowledging that the ramping of production in the previous decade had an incredibly negative effect on the price of the commodity. And it hurt the industry, really, because nobody was making money except for them. And that was unsustainable on many levels. So now they're partially public. They're still mostly majority owned by the sovereign wealth fund, the state of Kazakhstan, but they're 25% public, listed on the London Stock Exchange. So they now are saying that they want, now in this pricing environment, in this nuclear growth environment, they're wanting to increase production. And they were shooting last year for 2024's production to be 10% below subsoil use and 2025's production to be 100% subsoil use levels. And that would mean a pretty significant increase in production. So going from 60 million pounds a year, roughly, or last year they produced, 56 million pounds a year, to almost 80 million pounds a year within 24 months. And if you understand the type of production that they utilize, which is ISR production, in situ recovery, so they have essentially well fields, and there's injection wells and recovery wells, and they
right.
they inject a fluid that will interact with the mineral and pull the uranium out of the ground. So there's a lag time between well field development and the impregnating of the ore body with the lixiviant, with the fluid, and the time in which production can actually begin in that new well field. And that's about 12 months for first production, 12 months for first production, 18 months for peak production. So really, all you have to really do is look at their well field development CapEx and add 12 months, and then you'll see development from that increased CapEx. Well, we didn't see that. It was a pretty easy call to say they're not going to hit those targets for 2024. And what they've come out and said last month in their trading update is that they're seeing insufficient sulfuric acid. So sulfuric acid is what they use to mine uranium. That's the fluid they inject into the into the ore body. So it's a very complicated market. They produce some on their own. They buy some from other domestic production. They import some primarily from Russia. And that is how they source sufficient sulfuric acid to mine uranium. If there's not enough acid, or if there's not enough CapEx into wellfield development, or both, they're just not going to hit those numbers. So we expect them to revise. They already did revise down 2024 to basically in line with last year. They haven't updated 2025, and they're not going to until August. So,
So is this a supply chain problem, or is this a manpower problem? What's the problem? Or is this a demand? You know, there's so much demand for it that they can't, I don't know. Well, yeah, well, that's what I'm asking. What is the problem?
It's really difficult to pin it down to a single problem. And it's really difficult to understand exactly what is going on there, but I Not think it's somewhere it's yeah, exactly. It's somewhere in the intersection of multiple factors. One of those is that the country of Kazakhstan is, and the government of Kazakhstan, the federal government of Kazakhstan is very concerned about food inflation. Sulfuric acid's primary usage is in fertilizer production.
Got
so
makes sense.
To the extent that it is produced domestically, priority goes to the food production, period. So it can be expensive and difficult to increase the amount that they are buying domestically. As far as imports go, Russia has other priorities for their rail cars currently. So it can be difficult to import. It can be expensive to import if they want it. They can't fly it in. It's too heavy and expensive and basically has to be imported by rail car. Then you also have the company telling the public, and this was not in their trading update, but this is more recently at PDAC in Toronto just a couple weeks back, that they're expressing that they can get as much acid as they want. It's just too expensive and they don't want to set a precedent of buying at these higher prices. They want to wait until they have this new facility that they're planning to build to produce. So right now they produce, I think it was 680,000 tons a year, and they consume about 2.2 million tons a year. The rest they have to either import or buy domestically. They're building another plant that's going to produce 800,000 tons, which will get them a little bit more than halfway where they need to be. If they want to hit 80 million pounds a year, or 30,000 tons of uranium, they're going to need approximately 3 million tons of sulfuric acid. So that'll have to be produced by themselves at their own facility, bought domestically, imported. All of those things have to come together. So, yeah, it's difficult. It's complicated. But also, you know, to the extent that they miss their production, the market reacts to the upside.
Sure.
And their stock goes up, the price of uranium goes up, and they benefit from that.
Right.
So what is really the truth? Probably some blend of all of the above.
Right.
Our take, they probably won't see a meaningful jump in production until this new facility is built. And they just got the license or the permits or whatever to construct that facility a couple months back. They say it'll be operational in 2026. It's possible. They have every incentive to get it going. But, you know, the last plant they built took 6 years. So if they can do it in two, that'll be a pretty significant improvement. But of course, the last plant they built was when uranium was $30 or $40 a pound and in a bear market. Now it's $100 a pound. They're making incredible profit.
Right.
So they have every incentive to get it going. But
they can throw money.
If we give them the benefit of the doubt, they've got substantially more sulfuric acid in 2026. We'll see a jump in production in 2027. Between now and then, we might see some incremental increases in production, but probably not going to be the big jump until at least that point.
Got it. Now, let's take a step back to the truly where we're at. And by the way, that's a great, that's what I was asking as far as the politics involved, the geopolitics involved. But let's go back to the price, if you would. You made a comment that rang true to me because I used to be a futures trader about the curve, if you would. How is, and I'm just not familiar with the uranium market, how is uranium traders based on the curve, and what is the curve saying currently?
So the curve essentially is like the spot market relative to the term market, right? So the spot market is 12 months settlement or sooner. And the term market is everything beyond that. So there's a lot of variance in the term market, because if you secure pounds on the term market for delivery in 2 years, that's technically a term contract and qualifies for that label. Okay. But it's not that much further out in the curve than just, you know, a spot market purchase. If we look at the official price quotes, we would see, let's say for the month end, a February month end, we had the uranium price spot market, $95 a pound. The term market price, long-term price, was $75 a pound.
Right.
And what that is essentially is kind of the starting point for negotiating a term contract. Most likely that's the base. So term contracts can look like a lot of different things. And depending on the direction of the market, the momentum of the price in the market will dictate the details within these contracts. So in a bear market, there were a lot of fixed price contracts because that's what the utilities wanted, and it was a buyer's market. They could say, okay, we want to pay this amount of this amount per pound for uranium at the price of delivery. And of course, in a declining market, you had utilities basically flexing down on those contracts. So at the time of delivery, if they could receive less and at a fixed price, let's say they signed a fixed price contract at $55 a pound, by the time that material was delivered, it was $30 a pound. You're going to want to receive less of that and cover your needs in the spot market at $20 less a pound, right?
Right.
So that was the dynamic then. Now that the tide has turned and it's a seller's market because we have a supply constrained market, clearly the momentum is to the upside for the price. We have these contracts that are largely, if not entirely, referenced to the market. So at the time of delivery, whatever the spot price is, that's what you as the nuclear utility fuel buyer have to pay to the producer at the time of delivery. And oftentimes in these market reference contracts, you'll have floors and ceilings. So the floor price will protect the producer just in case there's a price washout in the market for whatever unforeseen reason, that at least you'll get this much per pound. So we believe that the floor price in these contracts being negotiated now is essentially what that printed long-term price is. So February month end, $75 a pound, spot 95. When you look at the curve, the official 3-year forward price, $105.
Wow.
The 5-year forward price, $111.
Okay.
So that's more realistically representative of what is actually being paid in this market for that material.
Okay. So then my next question jumps to equities then. Project equities out, they're not being valued. I'm going to, you're the expert. I don't see them being valued at $105 spot price. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I would say that maybe some of them are. There's a few equities in this space that you could argue are overvalued, but it's a really, really challenging and in some cases impossible sector to value. This is an absolutely vital commodity.
Sure.
Utilities will pay what they have to pay when they have to pay it. The cost of shutting down a nuclear power plant is enormous. You know, we're talking about, $1 million a day, you know, if you have to shut that down because you don't have the fuel for it. So I had one of our newsletter members actually did their own really interesting analysis and shared it with me, where they projected out what price would the cost of shutting down the reactor make sense instead of buying uranium. And it was something like $750 a pound, right? And then here we are at 90. And that's, of course, that's making a lot of assumptions and a lot of, you know, averaging out, and every jurisdiction is different, every plant is different, et cetera, right? So I'm not planting my flag on that number, but the point is, you know, you'll hear a nuclear utility fuel buyer say, if the uranium price is $1,000 a pound and I need it, I'll pay it.
Yeah.
I've heard another fuel buyer say, you know, $100 a pound is no big deal. $150, we're not happy about it. $200, we're really not happy about it, but we're still going to buy it because we have to.
There's no choice.
This is just that this it's such a unique commodity in that realm. Valuing the equities, most of these companies will never produce a single dollar of cash flow. How do you value that?
Right.
Pounds on the ground. There's a classic metric, which is not all that respected, but it's a decent way to make relative valuations between companies, which is just looking at the enterprise value of a company divided by their in-situ resource, mm-hmm. right? So you can go there. And if you use that metric, equities right now are historically very undervalued if you're comparing that to the previous bull market. I think right now, the contracts that we're hearing about that are being signed by the producers or the expected producers are far higher than the current spot price, right? So we're talking about market reference contracts with ceilings in $120, $130. And the momentum is to the upside in terms of the price in these contracts. And what I believe is that we are in early stages of the sector going through a significant repricing based on the companies that are producing or actually will be producing, doing forward cash flow analysis and plugging in a uranium price that is far higher than what all of these companies have done feasibility studies on, right? So you go back and you take a feasibility study from NextGen or Global Atomic or Denison.
$30. $40.
Well, if they did the feasibility study, 2 years ago, they were probably plugging in $50 or $60 a pound uranium. Okay. So realistically, when they're actually producing in 2027 or 2028, 2029, if they've got market reference pricing and contracts and they're selling the uranium at $150, $200 a pound, I mean, right. These are worth orders of magnitude more than what they're being valued at. And we're starting to see the early stages of that. We're seeing the analyses come out from Canaccord and Haywood and these companies that covered the sector, basically pricing in these higher prices and saying, okay, we've got much, much higher price targets for these equities.
Yeah.
With all of that said, valuation aside, this sector moves on flows, not on valuation. So the companies that have done really well, the equities that have done really well in the last 12 months with this new influx of capital that we've seen starting back in August, September, some of them are significantly overvalued, especially relative to peers, and they just keep going up. It's all right. About flows. When capital flows in, they buy the ETFs buy the underlying holdings, and it's this flywheel. And that's dictated the outperformers more than anything. It's just the capital flows and the fact that they were able, large enough to get into the ETFs in the first place. When money is flowing in and URA and URNM and now URNJ, HURA in Canada, Geiger Counter in London, all of these ETFs are buying the underlying holdings and the flows just move everything. And you can talk to money managers that are long this sector and they'll tell you straight up. Like there's a few funds that are specialists that focus only on uranium. We talk to these guys pretty frequently. And they'll tell you that they talk to generalist funds all the time. And when a generalist fund is interested in going long the sector, they do not do discounted cash flow analysis. They bring up their Bloomberg, they look at the top five most liquid, and they buy them.
Yeah.
That's all they do. Liquidity is paramount. Doesn't matter valuation, enterprise value, the pounds on the ground, none of that. It's all irrelevant. It's liquidity and it's flows.
Yeah.
And that historically has been what moves this market more than anything.
And that reminds me, that's a lot of them, if you were the commodities market. So for example, I used to work for a fund, this was 15 years ago, and the investors wanted exposure to gold, and it was really by the top 10 gold producers. That was it. I was literally it. There's no analysis, just by the top 10 largest gold producers. And so it kind of reminds me of that. So let me take a step back then. Is it sounds like there's an opportunity then for the person that does the homework, looking at, I guess, going into the books and looking at what a company actually has in the ground, then there would be an opportunity there for an investor. And then the second part is, it seems like this is starting to, again, you made a comment in the first part that's consolidating. It also seems like it's starting to coil again, if you would, for another significant move in the next, I don't know, 12, 24, 36 months. whatever. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, most of these zoom out and look at weekly or monthly charts on some of these equities or the ETFs, they're just gigantic cup and handles. If you look at a zoom out on a weekly chart of URA, it's a huge cup and handle. We, of course, believe that's going to break out to the upside, not just because we're biased and we want it to, but because we understand the physical market. That's where we spend most of our time. Most of our time is on the physical market. We want to know what's going on in the physical market. So for example, this move down from $102, $103 down to $90, that has largely taken place based on an extremely quiet spot market because the utilities and everybody that was in the spot market in December and January pushing the price up went, whoa, okay, we're going to step back here for a minute. And we have a single trader offering up a few hundred thousand pounds into a quiet market that moved the price down $10. If you don't know that, you might think, okay,
it's over.
It's over. It's reversing. It's done. We, of course, are going to take the other side of that bet. So we think things will break out to the upside. There's a number of potential catalysts, and I don't like saying this because I don't like relying on catalysts, and I'm not relying on catalysts, and this is not something I'm actually hoping for, but the Biden administration just passed the funding bill that allocated, amongst other things, $2.7 billion to the nuclear industry domestically. A lot of that money is going to support the nuclear fuel cycle in this country, uranium conversion, enrichment, and especially enrichment, because enrichment is the, except fabricating fuel, which we have domestically, fuel fabrication capacity, we have insufficient enrichment capacity to operate the fleet. We're highly, highly reliant on Russia. So the past couple of years, U.S. utilities have pulled forward a lot of their legacy contracts with Russian enrichers to get that material because they're concerned about it being cut off or being sanctioned.
Sure.
There's currently legislation sitting on the Senate that could see a vote today or tomorrow or next week or next month. We don't know when, that aims to ban the importation of Russian uranium. And this would be a major shakeup for the industry. As I said, the United States is about 25% of global demand. It's the largest fleet in the world for nuclear power plants. So if this passes, technically there will be waivers within this bill out to 2028, where a nuclear utility can say, I can't find this material anywhere else. I need to get my Russian enrichment. I need to get that material. And those waivers technically will be granted. Right. But there's also the possibility that there will be some sort of retaliatory move by Russia to actually ban exporting the material if it's officially sanctioned. So that's not something we're hoping for or counting on, but there is a chance that both of these things happen. We don't see that. We don't see it being priced into the physical market yet. If the physical market believes that that's going to happen, we're going to see the price move. If it does actually happen, it's going to be a major, major driver of higher prices, at least for a short period of time.
Sure.
But it does look to us like this funding was one of those first steps to support domestic enrichment in order to be able to cut off the source that the country is reliant upon. We don't want the lights to go out. It's to almost 20% of the grid in this country. It's absolutely
right.
So that's one thing that could happen, and it could happen in the next couple of weeks. It could happen 6 months from now. It could not happen at all. Again, we're not betting on it.
Sure. Yeah.
But
it's a black swan. You just,
yeah.
You don't know if their level will happen, but we just know that they exist. So.
Right. But really the big picture is that this sector is now growing, 4-5% compound annual. We're talking about demand for nuclear. We're seeing life extensions across the board. We're seeing Belgium, that just shut down 2 reactors last year, wanting to life extend their remaining reactors. France is life extending. UK is life extending. The US, since the US passed the Inflation Reduction Act that has clean energy production and clean energy investment tax credits, every single nuclear utility that's operating a nuclear power plant in this country is life extending their plants. All of them. They're all applying for life extensions. Japan, just today, I read news this morning, Japan is wanting to do a 20-year life extension from one of their restarted reactors. They also have a petition by the local communities around a very large boiling water reactor that is set to restart later this year, potentially. So Japan is moving towards those restarts. Then we have this data center AI driver, potentially. Small modular reactors are gaining a lot of momentum around the world. Canada's building 4 GE Hitachi BWRX 300 small modular reactors, are currently building them right now at Darlington in Ontario. There's a lot of drivers for growth, but even if we parse out these potential drivers like small modular reactors, we can look at the existing fleet. We can look at the reactors under construction, which I think there's 55, 54 right now globally, the ones that'll hit the grid in the next 5 years. And we can calculate that demand pretty easily. There is a lot of buying that nuclear utilities have to do in the next 5 years in a supply constrained environment. The gears are turning on the supply response. We're seeing small projects start to trickle in. But the big projects that are needed, like NextGen's Rook 1, the Aero deposit, Denison's Phoenix, Global Atomic Dawson, of course, Kazatomprom's ramp, all of those things are years away. And between now and then, I believe that the buying pressure just from the industry, not financial speculation, not hedge funds, just industry buying, is going to keep keep pressure under the price.
Got it. And just wait when those all of those kick in, which I see as inevitable. So listen, Justin, I'm sure you have to go, and I just want to really, really thank you for your time. It's been very enlightening. I'd love to have you on again. If people, my listeners, want to get in touch with you or use your services, where do they go and what do they do?
Yeah. Thanks again for having me, Andy. I appreciate it. I appreciate your time. We can be found at uraniuminsider.com. We're coming up on our 5-year anniversary this summer. It's been quite the run. We think it's been a moving target over that period of time as far as where we see this investment going. You know, when Sprott first took over Uranium Participation Corporation, and we saw capital flying into that fund, and they bought 10 million pounds in like 6 weeks. Like, okay, this could spike 6 months from now and take a long break before it recovers. That didn't happen, of course. We had a couple of spikes, but so far, higher highs, higher lows in the commodity. Now we have a compound annual growth rate in the sector that we never would have dreamed of. And all of these drivers, whether it's the clean energy revolution, whether it's energy security, the AI data center thing, I mean, small modular reactors, all of these things are sort of conspiring to make it look like this could be a very, very long-term sort of super cycle for nuclear and for uranium. So we're super excited about the future for the sector. And like I mentioned, we focus primarily on the physical commodity. We want to understand who's buying and who's selling and what volumes at what prices all the time. That's where we focus. Of course, we have our own focus list of securities that we recommend. That focus list portfolio has 5x'd, a little bit more than 5x since 2019. We've outperformed the benchmark by almost double, which should be URA, if you include their dividends even. So we're outperforming the market. We're very pleased with that. But of course, you know, we're nuclear advocates as well. Just besides this investment, I would like to see nuclear energy really take hold and grow a lot in the world. I think it's important for energy density, the return on investment for energy, the EROI, the energy return on energy investment. We've never seen that go backwards over the course of human history. We've gone from, you know, burning dung and burning wood to burning coal, to burning oil, burning gas and hydroelectricity, and then nuclear. And then recently, up until kind of this growth of nuclear, we kind of moved in reverse, going towards wind and solar. And that doesn't bode well for the proliferation of human well-being and human progress. And so we're advocates for nuclear, aside from the clean energy part of it, just looking at the energy density part of it and the potential for humanity within expanding nuclear energy sector. So it's a feel-good investment on that front as well. And everything looks pretty darn good as far as we can tell in terms of years ahead of us of pressure under the price. And we want the price to go higher for the industry. I know that sounds ironic, but we need price to incentivize technological advancement, incentivize production of uranium outside of the mining sector. We need every prospective uranium mine to come online in the next 10 years. Especially if we're talking about goals, like was just mentioned at the COP conference, a tripling of nuclear globally by 2050. That's an enormous task. And we have to find new ways of extracting uranium, and only high price will support that. So full speed ahead as far as I'm concerned.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much again, Justin. And I'll put all of your contact or your Uranium Insider into the show notes.
Thanks again, Andy. Appreciate it.
You bet.